now you want to turn on, like, just hit the button, yes, and then start changing. So the way you know that the microphone is working.
Yeah.
The agenda was distributed along with the motion 10 days ago and again just before this meeting. Are there any corrections or additions that need to be made? Hearing none, do I motion to approve? Motion has been moved and seconded. All in favor say aye. Opposed? The minutes went out again 10 days ago and shortly before this meeting. Are there any additions or corrections that need to be made to the minutes of the last month's meeting?
See how this is standing?
Hearing none, do I have a motion to approve? Second? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Matt.
You have to get on there.
Hi. Hello, everybody. Okay, so we're going to send you out some of the important dates. There's lots of exciting things happening, as you know. The writing awards are this week, and the fashion shows this week, and there's an honors celebration, and then there's the student awards ceremony. There's the ever-important graduation. There's the athletic award. So there's about 20 of these. And you will love each and every one. And so definitely, we'll put little check marks after them, and you can pick the ones you want, but you should go to a lot of them. These are this is the, for me, one of the best times of the year. It's one of the busiest times of the year. It's also one of the best times of the year because you actually get to sit back and be in awe of the student work. It's just a really cool time of the year. And I know it's busy, but try to make as many of these events as you can. Thank you. So yesterday, I was asked, somebody actually put makeup on me and asked me to talk in front of a camera. I think we're CCA, which is a company we work with, are making our videos, which will be shown. And, you know, they do this periodically at Baldridge's office. And the first question he asked me was, why is this a special place to be? And my first answer, because there's about a zillion reasons why, but for me, but the first answer is always my first answer. That this is a place where one person in any level can make substantial impact. It's not a place where I've seen people come here that were assistant professors or visiting professors that created programs. I've seen administrative assistants change processes. So this is a place where that can clearly happen. And so, as I'm sure you saw on email, Julia, our registrar, is retiring. And, well, she's not retiring. She's going to a better place or a different place. Okay, so Julia is going, if you haven't read the email, Julia is going to the other PU. She's going to Princeton University. And if you've never heard of it, they have maybe one or two more Nobel laureates than we have. And they have a really beautiful campus, but it is an incredible world-class institution. And she is a world-class person. And personally, she has had amazing impact on my life. And I've been provost for a short period of time, but I worked here as dean, program director, and so she did a lot of things which you can learn. But three things come to mind as far as her impact. One is as far as the process, procedures, compliance, she tightened things up unbelievably. I mean, there was some amount of organizational help that we needed, and she did it. The second thing she did was, no matter what you think, the office of the registrar is not just a place where things get scheduled, transcripts are placed, and compliance happens. It's a place where they solve complicated problems. And she was a master of this. It was not, no, it was, okay, let me think about this for a day. And then she came up with a creative legal solution that worked. And the third was, I think she changed the tenor of the place, of how it interacts with her office, how it interacts with faculty, how it interacts with other people. So I will clearly and definitely miss Julia, but she is going to Princeton, which is an amazing place, and it's cool, and we are so proud of her. So the next thing I'm going to do for about 5 minutes is just, it's an update. And it's an update on the, I just have to announce, if any of you haven't heard, we have a letter of intent to merge with Okay, so maybe some people were hiding with Punxsutawney Phil and not heard. But we will, so that's happening. And so just feel like I just need to keep people updated on this. Nancy had a great idea that after the main meeting, we'll have a lunch and we'll have sort of a fair where people can talk to the specific teams. But people off the most, I get two questions. One, what's happening? And two, how can I be involved? So I hope I will answer both of those questions today in 5 minutes or less. So it's... So this is sort of the timeline thing. You don't have to read all of this, but let's put this into a box. We have a letter of intent that says, here's a ring, we've been dating you, we'd like to get married, right? At some point, which we believe will be late June or first week in July, we will have a definitive agreement, which is like a marriage contract. But we will not be one yet. Lots of other people, our family members, our, the people we love, people like Middle States, people like the Department of Ed, people like the Federal Trade Commission that says we're not a monopoly, that we're not going to change the world, and Penn is not going to train its whole curriculum because we merge. A variety of people, we have to have, the IRS has to give us a tax ID number that looks like it's one tax ID, right? So there's a lot of people external, because we're a nonprofit and highly regulated, that have to make us one. And once we're one, they call that the closing. And we believe that that will happen late December to early January. Yes? Okay. So that's what we believe. So those are sort of the date things. But because we are not exactly one, we can start to cooperate and plan and even do things together, collaborate, but we can't act as one institution for any of those other purposes. So with Dr. Spinelli's leadership, we've created sort of these broad areas which are fabulous, and you will see these a lot of times. These are principles to guide the process and also attributes of the aspirational end state of an institution that we would like to see. And you don't have to read those all because we will, Pat Baldridge is going to take all of these PowerPoints and archive them on that site with the frequently asked questions, and you'll be able to go in into a faculty and staff part of that site and click onto some of these things. So you'll be able to see this, but if you are working on any of the teams, you're going to have this on your desk at all times. This is what the planning structure looks like. This is not what the org chart will look like. This is not what the org chart will look like. It's not what the org chart will look like. This is a planning structure. That's a great question. I was thinking, but probably not. But this goes into three columns. They're not silos because there'll be people from each of the areas on multiple parts of it. Like if you're involved in physical plant, you might be in any of the above boxes. But there's one that's called the student experience, there's one that's called academics, and there's one that is called administrative and support services. And this is what it looks like. There are, those are called areas, and then under those, these are teams, under those there's committees and subgroups. So each of these committees like academic affairs can have subgroups, and I will show you that in a second. And there's so this tells you a little bit about the integration timeline, so we'll be able to do things, and we'll talk about that again. This is Dr. Spinelli conceptual framework slide, and I'm going to admit, and my boss is here, that the first time I saw this, I didn't understand this. And the more I looked at it, the cooler this was, and the more it helped me to try to put my life more in focus, at least what I'm doing, okay? And so now we're going to send this out. You'll be able to see it, and if you stare at it for a long time, it doesn't make sense to you, please ask me or Steve or have a glass of Merlot, and it will make, you know, that helps. That does help with it or something, however. But dyad just means, it doesn't have to mean two people. It could mean two groups of people. But it's you and counterparts at TJU. The really critical thing that we have to think about, and it's on this slide, is that we are at the same exact time doing all three of those things. So we're operating because you have to put in final grades. We have to walk in funny black robes. We have to do new student orientation and put people in the system. We have to teach summer classes. The trains have to operate on as we are. But at the same time, we are doing planning on integration, and there will be times where we would like to say, well, we're going to save that to tomorrow because tomorrow's a lovely day, you know, whatever they say, along with the wind, but tomorrow's another day. But sometimes it's not, because sometimes there's opportunities in which some change happens in which we'll talk to them sooner, and maybe there could be points of integration that would be earlier. And then all of this is planned not to become like more efficient and have less people. It's to have more students, more faculty to grow. This is growth oriented. In order to do that, we need to keep a mindset that says we're doing all of these things simultaneously. So this is very cool. The integration process is a full 3 years. Obviously, there are certain things that would be really, really complicated that may take more than a few months. One of them would be faculty governance. Very different systems might take a while. And then there are certain things, there are certain lab things we can share immediately, right? So that may get done like in the second month. So it's a timeline continuum. So these are my principles for academic pre-planning, just to some of the committees that I'm directing with DR and with Cecilia and with Mark Kaczynski. One is to start with the big picture. What do you want to see? And then move into how many people would be on the committee or what software we would use. The goal is to make steady progress, to show early wins, and we'll show that, but also to realize that we want to get it right and we have a long period of time to get it right. The third is that we have an office over at, TJU has an office for everything, and they have an office just to deal with this, and they help with a lot of logistical issues. DR might say they have two or three offices for everything, but they do have an office for everything, and that's very cool. Our aim is maximal inclusion, and to get outside perspective. So if you're on a, say, a library committee, well, you might want some non-librarians on that committee. So that's up to Stan, but you know, you might. I mean, that would be good, right? Communication is really, really, really critical because stuff will be flying very quickly. So this is my opportunity slide, so I'll just talk about it for a second. As far as I can see this, a door opened. And it's a door that in my lifetime, and I've been doing this for hasn't opened very often. It's a door. It opens. It's for some people, it's a once-in-a-lifetime door that opens. But you're walking, it's not a door that you're just going to walk by and it's going to be this great success and people are going to throw stuff. It's a door to me that you walk down a hall and there are three doors. And the first door is people get scared, jump into silos, fight, and it becomes messy and looks messy. The second door is, let's continue to operate separately, but we can play together on a project. It's okay, we're better than we were before, we can get a couple of more pre-med students or whatever, but it's not what this could be. And the third door is the opportunity door. This is the door, and this is not, for me, hyperbole. This is, I truly believe this in a lot of areas, I mean, I truly believe this, is that this is one of the few times in my life where you can do almost idealized sort of design stuff where you blow up the box and you reimagine what it could look like. And for some things, like the Nexus learning thing, occupational therapy thing, simulation thing, clinical experiences, changing the foundation courses, the science foundation things for how we move people up, integrating the liberal arts into pre-med education. For certain things, it's unbelievably exciting. It's like, so for me, it's this opportunity is there, and you probably, there's probably a way to mess this up, and it might be culture, but it also could just be, you know, a lack of what the federal government would call a lack of imagination. Guess what? There's something that you all probably all know here. We do not suffer from a lack of imagination. This is the place that does not suffer from it. If anything, we sometimes don't have enough resources to put every idea into play. This is a time when those two could come together. But we have to think at the beginning, when, because you're going to be meeting, I'm certainly not going to be at all those meetings. I'm not even going to be at a part of those meetings. But to think about, I just ask you to think about that door and what that door could mean. And I mean, there are places where we could be preeminent, clearly. And hospital doesn't come up that often. So, that's my spiel. Okay, so early wins are things we can do now. The next 120 days will have a positive impact that we can measure on finances, or enrollment, or visibility. So if we can bring, say, create an articulation agreement with us and their nursing program. Their nursing program doesn't do the first 2 years, they send it outside. I'm just giving an example. And we can sign an agreement, because I'm on Mike Breyer's desk that probably left his desk today, and they can theoretically send somebody to our open house, which they did this weekend. And then the next day, we can get a deposit, right? And that happened. So that's like an early win. That's another human who wasn't there before. If I was telling Jeff Ashley today, the American Chemical Society didn't like us. We're accredited by them because we didn't have a working NMR. Well, guess what? Jefferson has a few working NMRs. So that might solve a problem. So any of these things, measurable, legal, sustainable, meaning it's not a one-off, it's something that, so if they come to Next Maximus, they'll come every year. So we've already gotten some of these, you will continue to provide more. These are what the academic teams look like and who the team leaders are. And we'll send this out, people can see this. These are the academic, and what you should be thinking about, or not, if you want to think about it, but one of the things you could be thinking about is where do I see myself? And like Nancy suggested, we're going to have that open sort of forum in May, but if you have an idea of where you fit before, please send it to me. And then some of these committees, look at this one, programs and curriculum, will have subcommittees that will work on specific things. So so they'll have subcommittees, and you can see some of these. They look important. And here's some other subcommittees for the academic affairs. And for instance, the one on teaching and learning, Jeff Ashley's committee, he told me today there's only two subcommittees. So. That's the overall big picture of what it looks like. We would like volunteers. We have already reached out. At this point, as of this morning, there are over 200 people from both institutions signed up. As Jeff told me this morning, he wanted to see it more, and that's why I'm reaching out to this one group. Obviously, there's lots of other groups of staff and students and alumni, but I'm reaching out to you saying, here's the groups that we have, where you think you fit in. Please join us in this. We could use your brilliant ideas. And it's one of the times when, like the strategic planning, when you get to shape the future of the place you work in. And that's very, very cool. So that's where it is. Thank you. We'll have more thank yous and stuff in the May meeting. And that's all I have to say. Send it to me. Send your name and what committee you want to be on, or what committee you think you would like to be on. They may recommend another committee. There were some people that were needed in other committees.
Not for a vote.
Contact me, and I will send it to the right person rather than me putting up a slide of who the right person is. There's like 20 team leaders, and just send it to me, and I will forward it to the right person. Okay. Any other questions? There's controversy here. Barbara.
I have a couple of questions. First of all, are we going to be able to see an entire set of the suggested committees so people will know what the different opportunities are?
Correct. So this is only as of today.
As of today.
But not all the subcommittees are going to be created yet.
So people could just send you a name and say, I'd be interested in being involved in this area.
Exactly.
And a person, when a committee is formed for that, you would know who wants to.
Exactly. For instance, that person, the point is, you don't have to send me the committee name, just send me what you're interested in. For instance, Susan and I could tell you where honors is in this, but there's not something that says honors, but honors is in one of those charges, right? So, yeah, so tell me what you're interested in.
The two other points about input or feedback. If we have an idea for a committee, I really haven't all been created yet, so we might be reinventing the wheel, but if there's a subcommittee that we think would really be important,
send it to me.
Send that to you.
People have already done that. You see the slide with all of them?
Yeah.
That's because three people sent it.
Okay. Good. And then the final thing is that second or third slide, I forget which, that has the guiding principles and the...
Dyads?
Not the dyads.
Attributes.
Is there a possibility for feedback there? To say we'd like to add this or get clarification on that or just...
There's always the ability to give feedback, yes.
Okay.
Yes, this is an iterative process. That's my design word of the day.
Iterative process. Okay. All right, good. Okay, great. So this will be posted. We can look at that and people can provide input.
Yes.
Great.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yes.
You mentioned that these slides are going to go off the website. Did the slides of the man who came from TJU, did they go off the website?
After we get his permission.
Because he kept saying, in the handout, you can see this. And it's very cool to see
on the screen. We have to get his permission. He's been really open, so I'm sure he'll give permission to him. Even though it says they put, their integration office puts proprietary on the... So as long as there's a thing that you won't sell this to other unions, tell yourself. Now I think we're going to put it up. I'll ask his permission. I have a meeting with him on Thursday. I'll ask his permission on Thursday.
So if you have questions about what these things mean,
yes.
Like number 7, action-oriented, balanced thought and action.
Yes, send those to
confusing to me.
Send them to Pat Baldridge and I, and we will make sure the right person answers them.
Are the faculty going to get a chance to discuss in general what these things mean?
Yes.
Okay.
We're going to do that in May. It will be part of, I think, things we can do. And,
So will we have input into maybe changing some of these things?
Yeah, I think so. Some of them, most of them are have been fine-tuned, but there's always room for fine-tuning more if it makes it, it improves clarity, yeah.
Especially as the faculty
member
had a chance to be part of
Some people were, yeah, but not everybody. The faculty has a one, right.
Yeah, I mean, most of the people, I think, most of the liberal arts people have said they
Yeah, some faculty have, but probably some have not.
So just pointing out that not every faculty person has had
it. Yes, absolutely. That's why I'm, absolutely. That's why we're doing this, and that's why we're going to talk about it in May, and probably we'll talk about it in September meeting, and eventually you'll be tired of this. But right now, it's exciting.
So I just, there's another issue which we've raised in our CSHAR meeting, which is that May to August, 9 month contract people aren't here to participate in any of this process, which seems like a big lack.
Well, it is and it's not. So let me answer that question because I've been asked that several times, and so I will answer it the best I can. So committees will go on, and there are certain committees that are like master planning, which will have mostly administrators on, where there would be no interference with 9 month people. There might be people if they are on them. Committees will meet, and if people are on them, they can come, certainly. Then there'll be certain committees that will be almost, well, not almost all, but say 80% or 75% faculty members, like governance, right? And that one, we don't have to get governance done by September. So they might only have one meeting before you guys leave, or they might, and they might pick up in September. So that if it's really faculty-centric type of committee, they may decide that they want to take that period off, and that's not one that's some emergency where there's a giant win. That's one where you want to be very slow, deliberate, and get it done right. And it may take a couple of years, so I'm thinking it's, but there are some that will have some faculty members on it that might be involving, but if it has, and that'll be the decision of the team leader. But certain ones like governance, probably not. Probably won't.
Curriculum,
well, there's not specifically one curriculum, there's one on programs. So, I can't answer that one because I haven't talked to that person yet, but haven't talked to everybody yet. But ones that involve those faculty will probably not meet as much of the summer. They might meet once. Okay. And then some that like on like some computer software thing, they may need more because they're all here. They may want to because this may be a downtime for them. So it'll be pretty individual, but people have asked that and we address that. They ask that on both sides of the Broad Street divide. Okay, we're good. And now is it Beth?
Not yet.
No, it's Nancy.
It's me.
Thanks, everybody.
Normally in the month before the meeting, I get people stopping in my office or sending me emails or passing me notes on campus for faculty voices. And that didn't happen this month. Doesn't mean that there aren't concerns out there. So is there any issue that somebody would like to raise at this time in faculty voices?
Held the box before. Do we need to announce ourselves?
Yes.
This is Stacey Van Dom. I'm in CSHLA. I just have a question about support for counseling services on campus. I had a student who really needed to talk to a counselor and couldn't make an appointment possible. So I know that was raised before and we talked about it before. I just wanted to see if we could sort of push that issue out there so we can keep talking about it. I think everybody knows that there are open hours between 4 and 5 every afternoon, which is kind of their backup time. The issue had come up earlier in the year because of last summer's lack of counseling support. I think that's when it had come up. Mark, do you want to talk about summer support and kind of the staffing over there to see?
My name is Mark Boney. I'm the Dean of Students here and constantly reports to me. So first, the standard construct of counseling. We have three MSWs, full-time, 9 and 10 months. So the way we work is we work by appointment. Appointments are made at the Dean of Students office by Lynn Carino, who's my assistant. And then each hour of the day, Monday through Friday at 4 o'clock, we have walk-in hours to be able to see anyone who was not able to get an appointment. Those are usually 15 to 20 minute assessments of the need of the student to see a counselor. They go on a waiting list and or they are referred to off-campus referral sources. We've had an extraordinary run on the counseling service over the last 2 years. We still maintain a waiting list now, 2 weeks to go in the semester. And roughly that's in the 20 to 30 category of students who have been waiting for an appointment. This is not good, but it is the way it is. We added a little bit more time to the third counselor over this past year. We had a 4-day-a-week counselor, and we made her 5 days a week. And we also added an intern who picked up significant traffic, 6 to 10 hours a week, and we're still running behind. This is a big trend line in higher ed presentation of anxiety and depression particularly. We're up to our eyeballs in needy students who need to see a counselor. That's the regular year, and there is absolutely no reason why a student couldn't have a discussion with one of our counselors during the 4 o'clock hour or get on a waiting list. How they get in to see somebody after that, it depends on the urgency of care and the numbers, frankly. In the summer, we do not offer full-time counseling in the summer after Kathy Barlow goes on a two-month hiatus. She's the director. The other two counselors leave after graduation. We have not had full-time counseling in the summer for 8 years. We had it as I came here 9 years ago. Traffic was very slow. So we cut back summer hours. Might be a time to add them. We are currently discussing the liaison we have with Atlantic City Operation for the PA program. Well, that ought to be expanded into more full-time counseling with a variety of different hours presented is a really good question, and I'm going to leave that for the next guy. It's in a nutshell. Does anyone have any questions for me to help clarify how we work?
How long is the wait?
Well, it could be so long that someone doesn't get in to see somebody. In other words, we monitor it regularly. We send out students emails. We encourage off-campus resources if they need them. And quite a number of students can't get in on their own timetable. That's a huge issue. Everybody wants to come into counseling between 12:30 and 2:30 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But skipping class or being too busy or having work, all that stuff factors into the accessibility of the counseling session. And if there's one person at 10 o'clock on Tuesday, and there are three people at 10 o'clock on Tuesday, then that hour is taken for the week and for perhaps many, many weeks. We have no limit to the number of counseling sessions one can have, and that's in discussion. It's not uncommon in college counseling centers to limit the numbers to 6 to 10 visits, something on that order. We have not gone to that model, but it's under consideration. The answer to your question is it could be that the person does not get in to seek our counselor in the entire semester. They give up. We don't have any space. They can only come during certain times. Yes?
So you mentioned that the waiting list, one of the things you look at is degree of urgency.
Yes.
How is that determined? Is there a triage? Or?
Yeah, as I said, at the 4 o'clock hour, someone can come in and be triaged or assessed for urgency. And then we try to flip some things around if we possibly can to make accommodations. The obvious, most urgent need is someone is considering self-harm or has self-harmed, then we work right away on that. And we have, of course, liaisons with mental health centers, psych wards, and that sort of thing. We have a psychiatrist who comes on campus 2 hours a week to monitor medications, and she's booked for those 2 hours with 10 or 15 students per hour coming in for medication monitoring. So many students on psychotropics at this point, that means basically managing depression and anxiety. We're just really overrun with previously diagnosed students, people coming in with counseling histories, ADD, the list goes on. I think you all know this. We've seen a dramatic upswing in mental health issues, even though we've dropped off in full-time undergraduate numbers by hundreds, but the presenting issues have increased per capita. Yes?
So with the upswing in mental health issues in higher ed overall, I'm wondering if this ever would impact admissions. If parents are concerned about sending their children to an institution that may not have a full complement of counseling services.
We have a full complement of counseling services. We just don't have them 12 months, and we're not keeping up with demand. I don't think, we certainly wouldn't advertise to people that your son or daughter might not get an appointment, but in fact, but it happens. Yeah, so I can't speak to that, but I think I can say from my many years in the business that this is the most pressure I've ever felt, and then most of us have ever felt in keeping up with the mental health issues. I think Starfish retention interventions, first-year counseling, other lay counselors, many of you help prop up students in many creative and extraordinary ways. This is one of our coping mechanisms rather than increasing the number of counselors and counseling hours, which under pressure may be needed in the future. Certainly a question for us as we join forces with TJU. Their model is very different. Their proportionality of counselors to clients is roughly the same. And we're all struggling, all small college and university counseling centers are struggling to respond to students. I would take your question and say that I think it's a retention issue. Now, we have had better retention of late. So we're obviously trying to respond and having some success with meeting students where they're at. But we don't get them all, we don't win them all. And I think it's very discouraging when someone who's truly in need, in your judgment, hasn't been able to get the help they need. There's no doubt about that. I think I'm going to pass this on, otherwise I'll be too long. Thank you.
Just a little bit of history. When we opened the Advising and Counseling Center in 92, we changed our model from unlimited visits to a maximum of 8. It didn't work. So at this institution, it just wasn't a good fit. So I pass that along as a bit of history. Are there any other faculty voices this morning? Seven, sorry. Okay, moving along. Faculty elections are almost over. The at-large positions went out a week ago. That ballot closes at 5 today. So if you haven't voted, and only 77% of you have voted on this cycle, please do so this afternoon. I will be sending out, as soon as everything's straightened out, if people get elected to multiple committees and we have to sort all that out, but I'll get that information out with the complete list as soon as possible. So thank you for those of you who have voted. The second item on there is one that, an issue that Barb Kimmelman had brought forward. We discussed it in shared governance. It went to the personnel committee, and Barb's going to explain it to you. It doesn't involve a vote, but I thought it might be something that you would want some further background on, so.
Yeah, it doesn't involve a vote because, I guess I'll come over here. It doesn't involve a vote because it's not in the organization of the faculty. It's part of the personnel discussion in the faculty manual. As you all know, when any application for a personnel action goes forward and a dossier is submitted, there needs to be a classroom observation completed by an administrator and a classroom observation completed by a peer that goes in with that application. We discovered almost by accident through a personnel action that occurred earlier that the current policy, or the policy that created what we felt was a problem, stated that those classroom observations had to have been made during the current contract term. On its face, that sounds very reasonable, right? You're in the middle of your second two-year contract. You want to be observed during the course of that second two-year contract. It turns out that the problem isn't really the course of the first two-year contract or third two-year contract. What was happening is that in the first two-year contract, the one just following the appointment, that application goes in basically, was September 15th, I think it's now September 1st. Basically, the semester has barely started, so to make certain that there's an administrative and peer evaluation, classroom observation, that's got to happen in the first year. It's got to happen in the first semester, second semester, all right? It turns out that a classroom observation made in that candidate's second year wasn't going to count because it was still in the first contract cycle. So that's what happened in our college. Somebody went in during that second year and we got told, well, that's not appropriate, right? It had to be during the second contract year. That meant that the second evaluation would have had to have waited until the person was in their third year there, when their second two-year contract had already begun. So it is kind of arcane, but so what I proposed, and I think has been implemented, is that the classroom observations can count as long as it was made after the submission of the prior dossier. So that if you can do that in the second, the spring of the second year. And it seemed really problematic to me because we all know it would be wonderful to go do a peer or administrative observation even though it wasn't going to count. But we all know that we're not going to do that because we're so pressed for time. So now it seemed like there was going to be this gap of a year or more in which a probationary faculty was not going to get an observation, was not going to get feedback, and so allowing any observation made after the previous dossier submission, right, that would allow a person to get some feedback in their second year and feedback in their third year, especially if we balance the administrative and peer, and that then those observations can then go in with this application for the second two-year contract. So I know it's a little arcane, a little confusing, and the only reason I understand it is that it happened in my college and I had to deal with it. But is anyone confused, not understanding what changed? Craig is here. The personnel committee discussed it, the UPC discussed it, obviously thought it was an okay idea. And they unanimously approved it. It seems like a win to me, but does anyone have concerns about the change or want input or have questions? Thank you.
Another place where a single person makes a difference. And we hear frequently from that single person. Okay. The next set of announcements. Do you want to use the wand or do the box?
That. It's not on.
Sadly, this is another case of a single person making a number of announcements. I'll try to make it painless. Last month, I presented to you on a new proposed policy about promotion for administrators with faculty rank. And I reorganized my slides a little bit here, and I'm here to report out on the open comment period. So as you remember, we have some colleagues among us who are full-time administrators but have faculty rank, but we lacked a procedure by which they could seek promotion in rank to associate professor or full professor. And so we conducted some benchmarking of other schools who have circumstances like this and how and what their policies were like. We consulted with our outside counsel about a first draft. We consulted with the deans, and then we rolled up our sleeves with UPC for several meetings to talk about every angle of the proposed policy. We revised and revised, and I brought it to you last month. I shared it with you all and received a number of very constructive pieces of feedback that I wanted to share with you. They resulted in some clarifications in the policy. There was a question about the teaching load that is proposed in the policy. It now says that Administrators with faculty rank should teach up to 2-3 credit courses or course equivalents in an academic year. That's a quarter of a full teaching load. Administrators or commenters were asking if administrators with faculty rank were still able to attend the faculty meetings, even though they were not part of the deliberative or voting body of the faculty, and the answer is, of course, yes. There was a clarifying question about whether there were separate types of assessment measures for the teaching of those administrators with faculty rank, and the answer was no, that we conduct the standard assessments of teaching regardless of who is doing the teaching. There was a clarifying question about the order, you'll recall, and the policy that was distributed, the order of the criteria. They were reordered from the faculty manual, which has teaching listed as first, and for these individuals, professional activity is listed as first. Just as a acknowledgement that the primary job of these individuals is administration rather than teaching, and there would be more evidence of excellence in the professional activity category, although we do evaluate excellence in teaching as part of this review for promotion and rank. There was a clarifying question about who the supervisor is in the case of a review for promotion, and it was ascertained that the academic or executive dean of the college or school in which that administrator teaches would serve as the supervisor for the review. And then the final question was, how many years of teaching should the dossier reflect? And the answer was, all student evaluations of teaching should be included, so the dossier should be inclusive of all of those courses since higher or the last promotion in rank. And so with that, we would like to adopt this operational policy and have it be effective in the 2016-17 academic year, allowing people to prepare and move through that process in the future. Any questions? I appreciate everyone's comments. As I said, they were very constructive and exactly what we expected. I'm next on the agenda, so I will just take us back to the agenda for a moment. When Matt Baker undertook his first set of reviews for sabbatical applications, he asked some questions about the applicants, which we thought could be answered by the applicants themselves at the time of application. I distributed this as part of the handouts for the faculty meeting. And so beginning next year, there will be an applicant cover sheet for the sabbatical applications, and it will ask for just some general standard information about the individual and about the circumstances around the sabbatical plans. And this will help, I think, with all committee reviews and with administrative reviews of the applications. And then for the first time, there will be a standard application format with some basic questions and content that we're looking for, and some page limits to keep people from feeling like they have to submit a dossier for their sabbatical application. That was distributed last month, and there are some evaluative considerations rather than a rubric with scoring, just to give you a sense of what folks are looking for when they're reading your application and comparing it with others in the context of the number of applications that are available for that next academic year. Does anyone have questions about the sabbatical cover sheet or application process? The last change about sabbaticals is that there's a clarification in the faculty manual about sabbatical eligibility. And so the proposed language is that tenured and practice faculty who are in their seventh year of full-time service at Philadelphia University are eligible to apply in their seventh year for an initial sabbatical leave, which, if approved, would occur no sooner than their eighth year of full-time service. And this is a change where you have to be in your eighth year to apply. And so we are syncing up our sabbatical language with what we think is an industry standard, allowing you to apply in the year after sabbatical, tenure or long-term contract was awarded. Any questions about that? No. Okay. The Academic Administrative Council has been busy this semester. I believe the Academic Administrative Council is the sister to the Faculty Council. And two policies, a number of policies have been revised or worked on this semester, two of which I'm presenting to you today. The first is the minimum enrollment and cancellation, course cancellation policy. So this is a assembly of working policies that we've had for a number of years. They are now all in one place so that we're all on the same page, so to speak. This policy, for the first time, sets the minimum course enrollments for undergraduate and graduate courses. This has been, I think these have been practices understood by deans across colleges, but never written in a final document presented to the faculty and posted on our resources page. So it does say that the optimal minimum number for an undergraduate course is 8, and the optimal minimum number for a graduate course is 5. It describes the extenuating circumstances under which a low-enrolled course section might need to run, and they're listed there, and we know what they are. And I know the MAOs are very good at working with program directors around those situations, and there's a lot of trust that you are making those decisions for the right student-centered reasons. It articulates the course cancellation policy, some of which is in adjunct faculty contracts, and now we have it stated here. And it describes the course cancellation procedures, which start with MAOs and program directors, and then make its way down to the registrar and to human resources if the course is being taught by an adjunct faculty. And it includes the new course cancellation payment procedure for adjunct faculty that we discussed in the fall. And it also, as the other end of the barbell it also describes course cancellation procedures for full-time faculty, giving lots of flexibility there for if you have a course section that's canceled or consolidated, that there's room for a supplemental administrative assignment or a different teaching load in the next semester of that academic year. Any questions about those assemblies, that assembly of policies in one place? Yes?
You said a minimum of 8 for undergraduate classes. Does that include summer classes as well?
Yes, we didn't differentiate between summer and academic year. Other questions? Thank you. Okay, I promise this is my last one. Trans college teaching policies. This was raised by a dean as a question about how do we optimize the kind of institution that we are and the inclinations of faculty to teach across curricula, and also to help program directors in need when there is a course section that needs to be staffed or a curricular enrichment opportunity that someone could step in and teach well. And so this policy, it puts forward four reasons for the intention of this policy. It says that we're trying to provide a framework for faculty to have a rich and rewarding teaching experience. We're trying to protect faculty time for professional activity, research, and scholarship, that is to say, not overloading with teaching. Supporting the dean's role in coordinating and mentoring full-time faculty, and also supporting program directors and course coordinators in the management of the courses for which they're responsible. And the policy says that faculty have their first responsibility to teach in their home program. But it's understood that at a place like this, where we have many multidisciplinary programs and courses, that they may be called to teach in other programs that might be interesting to them and might be very useful to the program director in need. And it really sets forth a procedure for that, which starts with the program director or the MAO talking with that faculty member's dean. And it says what the dean will do in considering that request, including talking to the faculty member himself, him or herself, and making an informed decision about if the home program can have that faculty member released from the home curriculum and teach somewhere else, or if the faculty member is interested and able to teach an overload. And then the policy establishes the procedures for the instructional costs associated with either replacing that faculty member in the home curriculum or paying the faculty member to teach an overload. Questions about that? Nothing. Well, all right. Thank you very much.
Revisions change the eligibility requirements within both undergrad and grad internships with the hope that more students could participate and allow flexibility in working hours. So the proposal has been through the AOO open review process March 14th through 24th and received feedback that has been included in the motion that you see before you. And the proposal has also been available for review for the required 10 days before bringing the motion before you today. So Tracy and Laura are here to ask and answer any questions you may have. We need a second first.
Make the motion, ask for a second.
Okay, a motion to vote on the revisions to the academic internship program.
Do you have a second?
Second.
Discussion?
Any discussion?
How big is the population of students that are participating?
Total number of students that are participating.
How would it be affected by this?
So each year we have approximately 140-150 students that participate in the program. This past year, I would say it's about 55-60% that are undergraduate and about 40-45% that are graduate students. I don't know exactly. We mostly wanted to give access to those students so that they weren't ineligible to participate. That was easy. But look for this to come to your email, and that will be probably the only vote from me to you this month. Steve?
We need 2/3 for that?
We do not need a 2/3 since it's not a change to the organizational faculty. We might actually get this one through. Please vote. It's embarrassing.
Any questions? Matt took the whole presentation.
He's fired.
He did it better, and I would have. So I'm left somewhat speechless by the process. Yeah, I've never been speechless. This might be the first time in my 314 years of life. Does anybody have any questions about life, liberty, and the pursuit of higher education?
Okay. Announcements.
Hi, everybody. I'm Barbara Kinkham, Executive Dean in the College of Architecture and the Building Environment. I would like to actually announce to you, you might have heard it already, that Chris Harnish received a Fulbright. I'm very proud of this. He's actually going to teach in Malawi, in Blantyre, Malawi, at the Polytechnic Institute in Malawi, and we're hoping that he's going to pursue his research and his teaching there, and we hope that we actually can build a relationship that's going to be long-lasting. He has been working with the Polytechnic and with a Honolulu hospital, did I pronounce that right? Almost, okay. We'll run out for 3 years, and it's been very fruitful, many, many projects that came out of this, and so we're looking forward to seeing the results of when he comes back. I have two more, so okay, was Nancy? Okay, all right, good. We had a hopefully successful candidacy visit of the new Master of Architecture program about 2 weeks ago. We had the visiting team here. It went really, really well. I'd like to thank everybody who was involved, from physical plant to Marcella, who actually teaches and is in the Paley in the Design Center, who actually offered us the facilities to actually have the exhibition in there. I hope some of you saw it. It was very wonderfully curated by Donald Dunham and Jim Dörfler. I don't know if they are in the room, but it was really beautiful for awaiting the results of the candidacy visit. This is a pre-step to accreditation in our field, just as an information item. And then we actually got news yesterday that our teams, the Philadelphia University College of Architecture teams that were selected to participate in the Race to Zero competition, sponsored by the Department of Energy, won first place in the and second place. So we have two winning teams, which is quite amazing, in the category of detached housing. We didn't get the grand prize, but we got those two prizes, which is really great. And just to put this into context, we had 182, not 131, Pat actually put that note yesterday. Teams were submitted, 35 teams were selected from 25 universities in the United States, most of which are Research One institutions, and Philly was part of it, and we actually got two of the awards, which is quite amazing.
The only thing that I want to mention, and that is there's one more faculty meeting left this year. Normally it's a very busy one, so if you have items, particularly if there's motions, but any announcements, anything that I need to know about, let me know ahead of time. It's a really busy time of year for everyone, but it's the Thursday, the same day that grades are due, and I'm assuming grades are due at midnight that night, I think. Just checking, but it's, and kind of piggybacking on what Matt has already mentioned, as a result,
May 12th.
May 12th, at midnight?
Yes.
At midnight, okay. 11:59, okay. As a result of wanting to get as much faculty input into the integration process as possible, we've been trying to decide how to best do that, to include you before everybody disappears at the end of the semester. So what's in the works at the moment is the May meeting, which is that Thursday. We will have the normal faculty meeting, lunch, and then a working session afterwards to be able to have a more informed idea about what is happening at that point. Things are changing really fast at this point as far as subcommittees and committees and appointments and that kind of thing. And you will have an opportunity at that time, if you haven't sent Matt your name and ideas, to volunteer at that time as well. Okay. Anything else? Any announcements? Have I missed anything? Motion to adjourn? Second? All in favor? Thank you.
How many did we end up with?
20.
Well, we,